Peace of Christ be with you. Life is filled with defining moments. Sometimes those moments are exciting, sometimes they can be awkward. Defining moments like your first day of college or your very last final on your freshman year, your first date, a first kiss, the day of your wedding. Yesterday, I was participating in a defining moment for somebody and had a moment myself. I was officiating a wedding of two people who I thought I knew. And it came to the point where I welcomed everyone and said, "Welcome to the joyful celebration and union of, and I kept wanting to say his name was Tim, but I knew his name wasn't Tim. It was Doug. But I forgot. I was having a moment in somebody else's moment. Awkward. I said, "People, don't worry. I'm a professional." I regrouped, remembered their names, and we went on. Life is filled with moments, defining moments. Sometimes those are awkward. Sometimes those are exciting. But some of the best defining moments are those moments that are rare, that can launch us into a new beginning, a moment that can redefine relationships, reframe circumstances, a moment that gives us a fresh start. Every once in a while, the deck is shuffled, and the hand that you are dealt allows you on that particular day, at that particular time, to be launched into a reality that is larger than you thought possible. It pulls you up into a perspective that gives you the big picture, that allows you to see that all that has been before has prepared you for this moment right now. And this moment has the pregnant possibility to give new life. Tonight I want to take us into one of these moments in the life of Joseph as we come towards the end of the Joseph narrative in chapter 50. Listen to a defining moment in one of the people of God's life, Joseph. Beginning in verse 50, verse 15. Hear the word of the Lord. Realizing that their father was dead, Joseph's brothers said, "What if Joseph still bears a grudge against us and pays us back in full for all the wrong that we did to him?" So they approached Joseph and said, "Your father gave this instruction before he died. Say to Joseph, I beg you, forgive the crime of your brothers and the wrong they did in harming you. Now therefore, please forgive the crime of the servants of the God of your father." And Joseph wept when he heard them. And then his brothers wept and fell down before him, and they said, "We are here as your slaves." But Joseph said to them, "Do not be afraid. Am I in the place of God? Even though you intended to do harm to me, God intended it for good in order to preserve a numerous people as he is doing today. Therefore, do not be afraid. I myself will provide for you and your little ones." And in this way, he reassured them and spoke kindly to them. This is the word of the Lord. Life is filled with defining moments, and occasionally you get a rare moment that can redefine a relationship, where you have an opportunity to go one of two ways. You can seek revenge, or you can accept and pursue reconciliation. This is a story of one of Joseph's defining moments, and a defining moment for his brothers as well. But to understand that full significance, we need to get the backstory. For every story has a backstory. Every text has a context. The Joseph narrative in Genesis began all the way back in chapter 37. We remember that Joseph is the great-grandson of Abraham. Abraham, the one whom God made a covenant promise to bring salvation through the line of his blood. Through Abraham's line, God would reverse the curse and bring restoration to all the world, that his descendants would be like the stars in the sky. Abraham gave birth to Isaac, and Isaac to Jacob, and Jacob had 12 sons, and the youngest son, his favorite son, the apple of his eye, was Joseph, who he gave that beautiful robe to, the robe in which excited envy and jealousy from his brothers. It was this envy, and it was this jealousy, and it was this deep sense of not being chosen by their father that inspired his brothers to throw him into the pit, to pull him out of the pit, and then sell him into slavery. Joseph heads down to Egypt, and he is sold into slavery into Potiphar's household. He quickly becomes trustworthy. As Potiphar is the captain of the guard to Pharaoh's affairs, he takes over all of Potiphar's house, but he is wrongly and falsely accused of an adulterous relationship he did not commit, and he is thrown once again back into the pit, back into the dungeon. And he's there for years, days and weeks and months and years in the darkness, thrown out like somebody's old trash, forgotten from history. Nobody cares about who he is or where he is. All that he has in that dark time is the memory of how he got there, that he was betrayed by his brothers. All he has in that dark time are the dreams and visions that he had, that one day his sheaf would shoot up and others would come down around him and bow before him. But not now. Now he's in prison and in darkness. And all he has are these dreams and visions. Now, dreams and visions in this culture was a medium by which people believed God communicated to them. And those that could interpret dreams had special favor because they were said to be able to predict the contours of the future. Joseph was one of these people who had that particular skill of interpreting dreams. He interpreted some of the dreams of the people while he was in prison. And a reputation grew around him, which worked in his favor later on because Pharaoh himself had some dreams that he could not understand, dreams that haunted him during the day and kept him up at night, dreams that he needed to understand and all of his professional interpreters could not give him the meaning. Is there anyone in all the kingdom that can interpret this dream? Well, there was word that there was a slave stuck in a dungeon someplace that could interpret dreams, and so Pharaoh called Joseph out, told him his dream. And without blinking an eye, Joseph told him the meaning of the dream. It was a dream that said that you're going to have 7 years of plenty. There'll be 7 years where there'll be abundance of grain and harvest, and everyone will eat from the fat of the land. But then following that, there will be 7 lean years, years of depression and years of drought and years of starvation. So plan ahead, Pharaoh. You need to be able to, in the good years, prepare for those bad years. Pharaoh's so impressed that he takes this 30-year-old slave and puts him in charge of the entire kingdom of Egypt. Think about that. In 13 years, Joseph went from the youngest, clumsiest kid in his father's household to being sold into slavery, to be thrown into prison, only to rise to be one of the most powerful people in all the world. 7 fat years happen, and then it begins the 7 lean years, the years of depression, the years of drought, and all the world is starving, and all the world is coming into Egypt to get rations for food and grain so that they may not starve, so that their children and their children's children might have the hope of life. And it comes to pass that Joseph's brothers travel down from the land of Canaan to get their ration, to get their share. And what do you know? They're confronted by their brother, Joseph, but they don't recognize that it's Joseph. But Joseph recognizes them right away. He messes about with them for a little bit, saying, "Where's your youngest brother?" They say, "He's back home." "Well, you need to go back and get him." "But we can't get him. Our dad won't let us." And they have this little exchange. Finally, he confesses who he is. Confesses to his brothers, I am the brother you sold into slavery." They're dumbfounded and horrified and stunned. Joseph has them go back and get their father Jacob. The brothers go back and say, we didn't get the grain, but you know how we told you that Joseph was dead? Well, he's not. He's now the largest, most powerful man in all the world, and he wants to come see you. Will you come? Joseph is reunited with his father. Jacob and Joseph and all the brothers and all their children and their children's children are all gathered up into Egypt. And it comes to pass that they have a number of years together. And finally, the old man, Jacob, the grandson to Abraham, dies. Before he died, he gave instruction that his body was to be carried back into the land of the covenant promise, back into the land of Canaan, back to a tomb that he had hewn for himself. And so Joseph and his brothers and all the company of Egypt travel up to Canaan, and they bury their father and return back to Egypt. And this is the place where we pick up the story. This is the place where Joseph and his brothers have a defining moment. Verse 15 begins, realizing that their father was dead, Joseph's brothers said, what if Joseph still bears a grudge against us and pays us back in full for all the wrong that we did to him? The context is the death of Joseph's father, and the brothers are worried. Without their father's protection, they are worried that their brother's long dormant wrath might now be exercised upon their heads. They are worried that they might now reap what they have sown. They are worried that this will be a time where their deeds of collusion and plotting and scheming and lying is now going to be confronted, that they're going to get their due now. It's like a scene from The Godfather. Now that the parents are gone, the wounded brother can exercise his wrath on those that have done him wrong. And Joseph has every right. And Joseph has the power and the motive. And now, with his father gone, the opportunity, and his brothers are worried. They're worried that he still harbors a grudge. And grudges are funny things. They can start small, but they can grow in our soul in such a way that it can overcome our desires and our imaginations until we start scheming and plotting revenge. This is a reminder, I think, to us too, of how sin works in life. See, sin never stays contained. Sin is like a pebble or a rock that you throw into a still lake, and the ripple effect reaches the very farthest edge of the shore. You can't contain sin. It takes on a life of its own. Just because you did something wrong once, oftentimes the ramifications of that act are passed like a ripple for years to come. And you have that sense of guilt and of shame that sticks in you. You learn how to modify it, you learn how to live with it, but it's there all the time. Which is why one of the greatest gifts you can ever give yourself is a clean heart, is a pure conscience. Proverbs says that a pure conscience is more precious than gold and silver. And ever since that day when they threw Joseph into the pit, his brother's conscience, well, it's been uneasy. It's been agitated. Because ever since that day when they had to tell their father that Joseph was dead and they showed him the robe that they had dipped in the blood of a goat, they had been lying. Lying to their father and lying to themselves. Lying for so long that the lie started to feel like the truth. Until that day, they found themselves in Egypt and their lies were confronted face to face with the truth. The truth that Joseph wasn't dead but alive. They had to come face to face with what they had done. And it was in that moment where they had to confess that they realized that in this moment before Joseph, this moment as their father was dead, that the only one who could break the cycle, the only one who could banish their guilt and give them back a reconciled conscience was the one who was wronged. Only Joseph could give them the reconciliation that they desired. And whether they pursued it out of selfish motive or out of a pure conscience, we don't know. But we do know that they were afraid of their brother. And so they put words in their dead father's mouth and said, "Say to Joseph, forgive the crime of your brothers and the wrong they did in harming you." The brothers said that their father gave this, they gave him this instruction before he died. Forgive the crime of your brothers and the wrong they did in harming you. They volleyed the ball into Joseph's court, and this is one of the defining moments. How would Joseph respond? How would you respond? Joseph's response is to weep. Why does he weep? Maybe he weeps because of their brother's continual distrust of him. Maybe he weeps because he knows they're putting words into the mouth of their dead father, trying to manipulate a kind of reconciliation. Maybe he weeps because he remembers all of those days and months and years in the darkness of the dungeon. He's imagined this scenario more than once in his life, as he's put away like a sock in a drawer, imagining what it would be like to come face to face with those that have made it possible for you to be here, made it possible for you to suffer so much pain and so much loneliness, cut off from your family, cut off from your name, cut off from any hope of life, that his brothers did this, that more than once I can imagine that Joseph had fantasized about what he would say and what he would do if he was given the opportunity to execute justice upon those that hurt him. And here's the moment, and he can choose revenge, or he can choose reconciliation. And in the moment that he had maybe fantasized so much in his life, he begins to weep. And his brothers begin to weep. Maybe because when we wrong another person, it doesn't just hurt that other person, it hurts us. That they had carried this guilt and this shame all of these years themselves. Maybe in that moment, they knew that they didn't have to lie anymore. And maybe all of these years, they had wanted to tell their brother they were sorry. All of these years that they didn't have the chance to say, "We were wrong. I'm so sorry we did that to you." And here they're faced in this defining moment. And the brothers are together. And they weep. And the brothers fall before Joseph, and they say, "We are here as your slaves." And in that moment, the long dramatic arc from chapter 37 all the way to chapter 50 is fulfilled. For do you remember the dream that Joseph dreams in chapter 37? He says to his brothers, "I dreamed this dream. There we were in the fields gathering sheaves, and suddenly my sheaf rose and stood upright, and then your sheaf gathered around it and fell down before my sheaf." And the response of the brothers was to hate him and despise him. "Do you think that you are intended to reign over us and have dominion over us?" And that moment where the brothers are weeping and they fall before Joseph, helpless and vulnerable, willing to let him execute justice upon them, God's providence is revealed. That all of this time, God had been working out circumstances unbeknownst to them in order to preserve them, to preserve the family line. It's amazing, really. It's extraordinary. All of this time, God had been working behind the scenes. God's invisible hand had been working. I can imagine that the dream that Joseph dreamed when he was 17 years old, that maybe he thought that dream was ultimately about him, about his future greatness, which is partly why the brothers despised him and thought he was arrogant and above everyone else. But in that moment, Joseph realizes something significant that reframes his life. He realizes that that dream and that vision was not about him, but about God. He realizes that all along, the hidden hand of God had made it possible for him to be in a situation where God would use him for God's purposes, that the dream had really little to do with him and more to do with the God who intends to bring about salvation, a God who intends to break in upon our history and our moments in order to preserve a numerous people. In that moment, Joseph says something significant. In that moment when he could have exercised revenge, and rightfully so, Joseph speaks a word of reconciliation, a word of truth, a word of wisdom. And it is this word that I want us to overhear tonight and live into some of its implications. Joseph says this to his brothers who are before him and said, "We are here as your slaves." But Joseph says, "Do not be afraid. Am I in the place of God? Even though you intended to do harm to me, God intended it for good in order to preserve a numerous people as he is doing today. Do not be afraid. I am in the place of God. Even though you intended to do harm to me, God intended it for good in order to preserve a numerous people." This is an extraordinary word of grace in a moment where he could have acted in extraordinary anger. And I think that Joseph's words to his brothers have profound implications for us. I think Joseph's words are an invitation into wisdom into three parts. The first part is to hear Joseph's words as a reframing of reality, a reality without fear. Hear the first part. Joseph responds to his brothers, "Do not be afraid. Am I in the place of God?" Twice at the very end of this story, Joseph says, "Do not be afraid. Do not be frightened." He is inviting them into a reality that suggests to them that there is no context to fear from him. And why? Because Joseph has a particular vision of reality, a reality where he is not at the center, but God is at the center. "Am I in the place of God?" he says. Joseph understands something from his perspective of living. Sometimes when we're young and we're in the midst of life, we don't always understand that some of the circumstances we're in are the very circumstances God uses to put us where we need to be later on in life. But now Joseph is at that place of life, and he can look back and he can recognize, even though he was thrown into the pit, even though he had that season of darkness in the dungeon, God used that for good. "Am I in the place of God?" he says to his brothers. In other words, I am not God. I am merely a participant in the large drama of God. God is the one who is at play. And I think this is interesting for us because so many times we can do our kind of ethical reflection, pivoting from our own personal experience, our own personal hurts. But he is inviting his brothers who have come to him out of their own anxiousness of guilt and shame and reframing their perspective back towards God. For when we keep our perspective on God, it reframes a whole vision of reality where I am no longer at the center of all things. And it's because of that vision of reality without fear, a reality where God is at the center, where Joseph is able not to exercise revenge, not to choose a harsh word, but in other words, to direct his brother's attention back onto God. Joseph invites us into a wisdom that reframes our perspective of reality, where God, not us, is the defining center of gravity. The second thing that Joseph's response to his brothers is an invitation to reframe our present circumstances. Even though you intended this for harm, God intended this for good. And I think this is just a beautiful word to keep in our back pocket. Because there will be times, and I don't know what those times or what those circumstances will be for you, but you're going to feel like others are doing you harm. That relationship didn't work out. You didn't get that grade you wanted. You didn't get that job you were hoping for. Or maybe you have a condition that God has put in your life that you just can't seem to get out of on your own. But hear this word. Even though others intended something for harm, God intended it for good. In other words, God has a limitless power. God can transform circumstances. He can take darkness and make it into light. He can put flesh on dry bones. He can roll away the stone that there is no circumstance God cannot transform. Joseph is reminding his brothers that even though you thought you were doing this, you cannot thwart the work and will of God. That God will have his way. That God is sovereign. And that reframes our circumstances, no matter how dire or hopeful those circumstances may be. That we worship a God who can take our circumstances and make them his. And in that, there is always hope. In that, there is always the possibility that something new can happen. A fresh start can take place. That the old can be gone and the new can be reborn. Because God has the power to take old things, hurtful things, and transform them into new and beautiful things. My brothers, do not fear. Am I in the place of God? Even though you intended to do harm to me, there is a God, and this God's work cannot be stopped, and he intended it for good. Joseph's wisdom can reframe our circumstances. And we may be at a time where those circumstances are hard, but my friends, hold on, because you cannot thwart the work and will of God. God has the power to take darkness and turn it into light. Which is the third piece of wisdom that Joseph reminds us of. That ultimately, Joseph takes a step back and reminds his brother and reminds himself and reminds all of us who hear this story echoing down time that this is fundamentally a story about God, about what God does. We're at the very end of Genesis. And the whole book of Genesis has fundamentally been about a God who creates out of love. A God who can't help but love. That this creation begun in Genesis 1 and 2, and though stained and the scandal of Shalom happens in Genesis 3, ever since then, God has been working out a plan and a promise, a covenant made to Abraham, passed through Isaac, and then to Jacob, and then to Joseph. All the way through Genesis has been about a God who acts in history, a God who will save. This is the God we worship tonight, the God who is and was and is to come, the Alpha and the Omega, the God who is unchangeable. From all the way back from the very beginning to right now today, this is a God who acts, and whenever God acts, it is the work and will to bring salvation, to preserve a numerous people, just as Joseph told his brothers. You intended to do harm to me, but God intended it for good in order to preserve a numerous people. In this case, to keep a large people from starvation, to preserve the covenant line, the line in which God would bring salvation and restoration to all the world. It is this line that passes through Israel, through the prophets, through King David, all the way to the incarnation of Jesus Christ. And this God we see acting decisively to bring salvation for all on the cross. And this is the decisive moment of history. This is the moment that defines all other moments. This is the moment where we are reminded that God is still a God who acts to save. For the cross of Christ is the cross where God himself is present. The only one who can break the cycle. The only one who can banish the guilt is the one who is wronged. And in the relationship, an estrangement between humanity and God, between the creator and the creature, only God could reconcile that relationship. Genesis is pointing us to the cross, to this saving God. And the good news to us tonight is this God has saved, that it is finished, that the cross is decisive, that the blood of Christ is shed for all. And those who believe in him, who receive his name, he gives power to become children of God, where the old is gone and the new has come, where it can reshape our circumstances in your personal life, in our community life, the life of Hope College, the life of the United States of America, the life of every nation on earth, north and south and east and west. This is a God who saves, and his will and work cannot be stopped. God has the power to save numerous people. And by God's grace in Christ, we are part of that people. Not by any work that we have done, but always through the work of God who acts in history, in our time, in our place. And right now, the Holy Spirit is being poured out on all flesh to pull us all together so that we will stop being a people who will, in those defining moments, seek revenge, but that we can pursue reconciliation anew. For this is the work and will of God, that we would be knit together with God and with each other and with all creation in a sense of justice and fulfillment and delight. You see, I believe that these decisive moments happen every day. We come into the last week of school. And if there's any loose ends in our relationships, let's have some of those defining moments this week where we approach each other and we ask for forgiveness. And we can do that because we are not God, because God has acted to save us and reconcile us, and that we are free now from the long shadow of sin. And in that, my friends, we can have a new kind of life. It can be beautiful. We can put down all the hostility and enmity and strife, but we do that in God. We do that through God. And in and through God, we are given an invitation to a new kind of life. Amen. You should pray with me.